today. We should be live right now on both YouTube and Facebook. I haven't gotten any notifications that anything is wrong or off. First Sunday back for this class. You should have a set of notes in front of you for lesson 118. The Matthew's Bible, The Complete Work of William Tyndale, is what I'm calling this. So it's been a while since we've had this class in person. The last one that we taught, if you look at the notes, was on March 8th, was the last time that we had this class here in this classroom. I did do five lessons, looks like, on Coverdale from my home office during the shutdown in late April and early to mid-May. So we did continue this once we went on lockdown, after I kind of figured out what was going on and stuff like that. But we haven't done this for a while, so I want to reboot this. To me, us kind of having this class again is hopefully a step towards more of a normal, it's a first step towards more of a normal situation here at the church. So I appreciate all of you bearing with me. So we're going to get started on this, and this is the first lesson in the new term that we're going to have for this school year, and we're going to start with the Matthew's Bible. We left off last time, back in May, with the Coverdale Bible. And I just want to say a couple things. So years ago, back in 2015, 5 years ago, I set out to do this and to do it in a thorough way like we did with the Grace History Project. I had to take a year off in there because I had to go back to school for my continuing education for my job. So it was 5 years ago that we started, but this will be like the fourth year, I think, that we've actually taught lessons in this series. And it was always my intention to try to set forth in sort of a definitive way the understanding of the inspiration, preservation, transmission, and translation of the Scriptures. And to do it in a way that wasn't just sort of, you know, skimming over things, but to really dig in and understand what's going on, both in the history of the transmission of the text and preservation, and also in the history of the English Bible, of how our Bible has come down to us in our own language in English. And that's where we're at right now, okay? So just to be clear, for those who might be watching and so forth, it's been brought to my attention that some people out there are uneasy with some of the things that I've said, because they perceive me to be walking back a stance on the King James Bible. And I just need to tell you that that's not what I'm trying to do at all. Okay, I am not trying to walk back a stance on the King James Bible. I am trying to state a more accurate stance on the King James Bible that is free of a lot of errors and things that people have said that aren't true. And in doing that, I have criticized some of the things that have been said by fellow King James advocates because they're not in accordance with what I believe to be the facts of the situation. And so that's really what I'm after. I'm after the setting forth of a clearer, more complete understanding of these issues that are devoid of some of the errors that have been made in the past, okay? So I still believe my English King James Bible is God's Word for English-speaking people. Those of you that attend this assembly, you've never heard me correct it. You've never heard me say it's wrong. You've never heard me say a better translation would be. I don't do that because that's not what I believe about it. But that said, I'm not opposed to looking behind it and looking at what the translators did and trying to understand their processes that they used behind it, but never with the objection of correcting, okay? So let's get into the introduction. So the introduction, the last time this class met in person was Sunday, May 8th. I tried to get this set up too, by the way, the screen here, but it's giving me trouble, so I'm going to have to spend some more time with it. It was Sunday, May 8th, when we finished up our discussion of William Tyndale in Lesson 112. So that was the last study we had in this room before we had a coronavirus shutdown, and it was the last study that we did on William Tyndale. The next Sunday would have been, I think, March 13th, or I don't know, that's probably too soon, but it would have been somewhere in mid-March, and we were going to be starting a study of Coverdale. Then after about a month-long break, I taught Lesson 113, the first lesson on Miles Coverdale, remotely on Sunday, April 19th. Then on Sunday, May 17, in Lesson 117, we wrapped up our discussion of Coverdale by assessing the contents of the first complete English Bible. All told, we devoted 5 lessons to a consideration of Miles Coverdale and the first complete Bible printed in English. Okay, so remember that Tyndale's work was never completed, right? He was arrested and executed before he finished his work of translating the entire Bible. The first person to present a completed Bible in print. Wycliffe had done it before in manuscript form or handwritten form, but the first person to give a complete English Bible in print from Genesis to Revelation was Miles Coverdale. Okay, and we spent 5 lessons looking at that. So just to review quickly. So we looked at Coverdale Bible assessing its impetus in Lesson 113. Lesson 114, we looked at the Coverdale Bible assessing its source. Where did it come from? So the first one is what led Coverdale to do it. The second one was where did it come from? What materials did he use? And remember there that we saw that he was very reliant on the Latin Vulgate, which is very contrary to the standard narrative that's out there amongst King James advocates of what Coverdale did. And so that was one of those points that we needed to get clarity on. The third lesson on Coverdale, lesson 115, was assessing Coverdale's ability as a translator. In 116, we looked at assessing Coverdale as a reviser of Tyndale. And then in lesson 117, we looked at assessing the contents of the first complete English Bible. And remember that in that lesson 117, we spent a lot of time talking about the Apocrypha and how Coverdale handled the Apocrypha in his Bible. Recall, if you will, that he set it aside in its own separate section, and he did not disperse the apocryphal books throughout the Old Testament canon the way that you would find them in a Catholic Bible. He set them aside with its own title page, identifying that the apocryphal books are not found in the Hebrew text. So I'm not going to go through all those details again. I spent a lot of time talking to you about that and discussing how Coverdale, in doing that, set a precedence for how the Apocrypha would be handled in the English Bible moving forward. So if you want all that information, I would go back and look at Lesson 117 again, okay? So this morning in Lesson 118, we're going to pick up where we left off last spring and begin looking at the next English Bible to be printed, which is the Matthew's Bible from 1537. So I actually have with me, this is my copy of a Matthew's Bible. Hendrickson Bibles put out this reprint of a 1537 Bible, and this is done from photostatic images of one of the only surviving copies of a 1537 Matthew's Bible. So I picked this up at Baker Bookhouse a number of years ago, even before I was actually teaching this class, because I wanted to have as many of these documents as I could. You can also download this in PDF form for free off of the internet, the exact same thing that I have right here in hard copy, okay? But this is the Bible that we're going to start looking at this morning, the Matthew's Bible. The Matthew's Bible, I didn't know a lot about it before I started doing the research for this, okay? And I'll say that it's a very important Bible that does not get nearly enough attention. And hopefully by the end of this lesson, you'll see why, and then I'll explain that to you more in future lessons. But the Matthew's Bible is an extremely important Bible because what it does is it sets forth all of the translations of William Tyndale in print that he did before he died. Okay? So it includes his Pentateuch, Genesis through Deuteronomy, it includes Joshua through 2 Chronicles, it includes Jonah, and it includes the whole New Testament as rendered by William Tyndale. So we'll talk more about that here in a little bit. So the first point then is, who was John Rogers? John Rogers was born somewhere around the turn of the 16th century. Historians differ on exactly when this prominent figure in the history of the English Bible was born. Donald L. Brake, author of A Visual History of the English Bible, offers the following time and place for Rogers' birth. He says, quote, the turn of the 16th century witnessed the birth of John Rogers. So somewhere around 1505, somewhere in that area, some people put his birth at 1500, Some people put it at 1505. We don't know for sure exactly what year John Rogers was born. But he was born near Birmingham, England. J.I. Mombert is more vague in stating that Rogers was born about 1500. So we don't really know when Rogers was born for sure. All right. While little is known about Rogers' birth and early childhood, much more is discernible about his formal education and adult life. Educated at Cambridge, he received his B.A. in 1525. Now, you can derive that from the records of the university. Okay, the records of Cambridge University state in the record that John Rogers graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1525. The same year, Rogers received an invitation to Christ Church, Oxford, then known as Cardinal College. So he's a Cambridge, Oxford educated person here in the early 16th century, or in the first quarter of the 1500s. As usual, Dr. David Daniel, author of The Bible in English, Its History and Influence, offers the most thorough treatment of the subject. So I'm on top of page 2. So here's his quote. He says, quote, "Having taken his B.A. at Pembroke Hall, Cambridge, in 1526, so he differs a little bit on the date, Rogers became rector of London Parish. So that means he was a church figure and a preacher, and he was working within the parish of London after he graduates Cambridge. In the later part of 1534, he moved to Antwerp to become chaplain to the merchants and others who lived there together. He was moving in reforming circles, and in 1536 or 1537, he married a Flemish woman who was a kinsman to Jacob von Mertren. So von Mertren is a Bible printer who we've talked about a lot already when we looked at the Tyndale Bible and also Coverdale. The latter had been the sponsor behind the printing of Miles Coverdale's English Bible in 1535. Rogers stayed for 6 years in Antwerp. He then left for Wittenberg. So that would be, he leaves and he goes to Germany, where he matriculated on 25 November 1540. He came into close contact with Lutheran scholars, particularly Philip Melanchthon. Now, Melanchthon is Luther's right-hand man in Germany at this time. He is sort of Luther's protege, the assistant to Luther, probably maybe one of the greatest linguistic scholars in Europe at the time. Philip Melanchthon was a brilliant person in that regard. He came into close contact with Lutheran scholars, particularly Philip Melanchthon. He then became one of four superintendents of the Lutheran church at Dietmarsh region far in the northwest of Germany. Backed by Melanchthon, he accepted the challenge of becoming part of the Meldrov in that region. So that's a word referring to the clergy in the Lutheran church. Rogers remained in Meldrum for 4.5 years until the spring of 1548. In January of 1547, Edward VI came to the English throne, and Rogers set about returning home. Now, so Edward VI is the son of Henry VIII. So when Henry VIII dies, his son, Philip VI, is going to succeed him to the English throne. Edward is a sickly individual, and he's going to die. He's not going to reign England very long before he dies. And when he dies, he's going to be replaced by Mary. You might have ever heard of her, Bloody Mary. Okay, she gets her name because of her crusade against Protestants in England, which we'll talk more about later. Okay. So in January 1547, Edward came to the English throne, and Rogers set about returning home. He left Meldrum to the evident grief of his people probably in the spring of 1548. By August, he was living in London in the house of the reforming merchant and publisher Edward Whitchurch. He translated a number of books by Melanchthon, including The Weight of the Interim referring to the Emperor's Edict of 15 May 1548, bidding Protestants to conform to Catholic practices. He was already given a number of successive London livings of increasing influence, and admired by Ridley, he was appointed lecturer of divinity at St. Paul's Cathedral. In April 1552, his wife and those children born in Germany were naturalized as English. So here's what you need to get from this. He is not a Catholic. Rogers is embracing the Reformation. When he flees England and he goes to the continent, he goes first to Antwerp, and he is running in the same circle as William Tyndall in Antwerp. When he leaves Antwerp and he goes to Germany, he goes to Wittenberg, he's running in the highest circles of the Lutheran movement in Germany at that time. So he is definitely not a Roman Catholic. He's embracing the Protestant movement, especially with its movement to put the Bible into the language of the people. And so Rogers is definitely moving in that direction, and he is not embracing the Roman Catholicism at this time. So from this we can conclude that Rogers was a member of the Protestant movement and therefore objected to many of the teachings and practices of the Roman Catholic Church. Laboring with Philip Melanchthon in Germany, Luther's right-hand man, it meant that Rogers ran in the leading circles of the Protestant movement, both on the continent and in his homeland of England. When Queen Mary, also known as Bloody Mary, succeeded Edward to the English throne in 1553, she saw to it that Rogers was the first Protestant to be executed, thus inaugurating her bloody campaign against English Protestants as she sought to place, should say England, sought to place England back under the authority of the Pope. Okay? So I don't know how much you know about your English history, and here's a marker. So you have Henry VIII. When Henry VIII dies, he is succeeded by his son, Edward VI. When Edward dies, Bloody Mary is going to, or Mary, I'm just going to call her by her, you know, affectionate Protestant name, Bloody Mary. She's going to take the throne. She's going to reign for a while. And then what ends up happening is Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, is going to succeed her. Okay? So Rogers is going to move back to England when Edward becomes king. He's not going to rule very long. And when Mary becomes queen, Rogers is the first person that she executes, inaugurating her campaign against English Protestants, because what Mary is doing, Mary hates her dad. The reason Mary hates her dad is because of all the business that her dad did with, you know, like divorcing and then having one of his wives executed and all this sort of stuff. So Mary hates her dad. So when Mary comes to the throne, she's going to seek to move England back under the authority and jurisdiction of the Pope. And so she's going to persecute Protestants in England at that time. Well, the first guy she's going to kill is John Rogers. So again, that shows you his perceived influence within the Protestant movement at that time, especially as it relates to the English Bible. So before we go to the next point, does anybody have any questions? Nope. All right. So point two. The Matthew's Bible, the complete work of William Tyndale. Point one. Recall from lesson 105. I know you all remember that lesson. I remember that. No, I'm just kidding. Recall from lesson 105 that William Tyndale was arrested in Antwerp, Belgium on May 21st, 1535. So this puts Tyndale and Rogers together in Antwerp and living in the English house at the time of Tyndale's apprehension. So it is beyond historical doubt that Tyndale and Rogers knew each other. They were living in the same, there was a house there in Antwerp. It was known as the English House because a bunch of English people were living in the house. Alright? And they all had sort of their own rooms or their own living quarters. And John Rogers and William Tyndale were living in Antwerp at the English House at the same time. Okay? So it is therefore beyond historical doubt that the two men knew each other. Tyndale was strangled and burned on 6 October 1536. In the 16 months after his arrest and removal from Antwerp to Brussels, it is not known what happened to his manuscript translations of Joshua to 2 Chronicles. The pages would be bulky. Somehow, on Tyndale's arrest, They survived Pierre Dufry's illegal raid on the English house to seize all his property. He was the man who made sure that they went to print. So the guy who's there at the English house when Tyndall is arrested? John Rogers. Rogers has the presence of mind to secure Tyndall's manuscript copies of Joshua to 2 Chronicles and save them from the Catholic authorities that are arresting William Tyndall. You guys following that story, right? So Rogers is the guy that rescues this portion. Now, at the time, it would have been a handwritten manuscript of Tyndall's translations. What Rogers is going to do is he's going to take that and he's going to move all that into what? Into print. He's going to move it from manuscript into print in the Matthew's Bible. Okay, so let's keep going. He was the man who made sure that they were printed in what became the most influential of all the early printed English Bibles, the Matthew's Bible. In 1535 and 1536, Rogers, a friend of Tyndall, was an ideal person to take the translator's work farther. He, referring to Rogers, was a graduate with an undoubted flair for languages. He could hardly go to Antwerp not knowing the name of Tyndall. So those two guys know each other. They're living in the English house at the time that Tyndall is arrested. And the indication is that Rogers secures somehow. It's unclear whether Tyndall gave him the manuscript or whether Rogers somehow knew where it was and secured it before it could be confiscated by the Catholic Church. Therefore, the Matthew's Bible is of a major historical significance because in it we find the complete work of William Tyndall, i.e., all the portions of the Bible that he translated before he died. Regarding this matter, Professor Daniel states the following quote, "To this steadfast and courageous Reformed pastor and preacher, the English-speaking Christian world owes a debt of particular gratitude. Working with, apparently, the printer Matthew Crom in Antwerp, John Rogers put together in 1537 a handsome thick folio," so that's this volume right here, he's referring to this Bible. This Bible does not have hardly any extra material in it, so this is exactly what it would have looked like when it was published in 1537, okay? "A handsome thick folio, well printed in clear black letter in double columns." So I'm going to come around here and show you this. So this is clearly black typeface, and you can see that there's two columns of text on each page. So this is what it actually looked like in 1537. There is also in here some color printing. So this is the title page, and you can see that there's some red type on this page. This is something that we haven't observed yet in the other Bibles that we've looked at, actually some colored ink. Okay? So this is what it looked like, this edition that Rogers puts together in 1537. "This contained," so on the next sentence there, "this contained for the first time, as part of a large, complete Bible, all Tyndall's printed Bible translations. That is, the 1534 New Testament." So it's got, what does it have in it? The 1534 New Testament. So remember that Tyndall did his work in 1526, and he revised it in 1534. So this Bible, the Matthew's Bible, has the New Testament is nearly exactly identical to the 1534 New Testament published by who? By Tyndall. You guys following that? And the Pentateuch. So it also includes Genesis through Deuteronomy. And remember that he published that around 1530. So it's got Genesis through Deuteronomy in it as well. So it's got Tyndall's New Testament, it's got Genesis through Deuteronomy, the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. They were also, they were given almost unchanged. "For the first time, moreover, there appears in English a translation of the nine historical books ending at 2 Chronicles made from Hebrew." So, 1537 now, in the Matthew's Bible, he includes from Tyndall Joshua, to what? Second Chronicles. Okay? He includes Joshua to Second Chronicles, and he also is going to include Jonah. How do you spell Jonah?
J-O-N-A-H.
It also includes the book of Jonah, which he had done previous. Okay, so let's go back to the notes. They were given almost unchanged. For the first time, moreover, there appeared an English translation of the non-historical books, ending at 2 Chronicles, made from Hebrew. That this was the work of Tyndale is now beyond doubt. Tyndale's vulnerable manuscript pages had safely arrived in print. So, we have, therefore, in the Matthew's Bible, the complete work of Tyndale in print, available before he was what? Executed. And who do we owe this to? We owe it to the work of who? John Rogers. Is everybody following? Anybody got any questions? Okay. In lesson 108, we looked at the connection between William Tyndale's translation work on the Old Testament and the Matthew's Bible. Please bear with me as we look again at the following points from lesson 108. And I know you all totally remember all of this, right? So, no. That's why I included it here again. So in 1992, Dr. David Daniel edited a modern spelling edition of Tyndale's Old Testament for Yale University Press. Okay? So that's this book right here. This is the second book I brought with me this morning. So this is the 1992 edition of Tyndale's Old Testament, translated by William Tyndale and edited just with modern spelling by David Daniel in 1992. So we talked about this back when we looked at lesson 108. This volume included Tyndale's Pentateuch, Genesis through Deuteronomy from 1530, Joshua to 2 Chronicles from 1537, the book of Jonah, as well as an explanatory introduction of its contents and layout. Dr. Daniel's introduction to Tyndale's Old Testament opens with the following statements. Quote, William Tyndale's Old Testament translations laid the foundation of our English Bible. They have been even more hidden from general view that this work than his work on the New Testament. Half of what appears in this volume has not been generally accessible since 1551. So, a bunch of the material that's in here, most people couldn't really get a hold of it since 1551 unless they had what? One of these. You following that? Okay. Tyndale published his first translations from Hebrew into English, the earliest ever from that language into this, in 1530, when he printed his Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. He gave us our Bible language, the words and rhymes, for example, the story of creation and the fall, let there be light and there was light. Male and female created he them. Who told thee thou wast naked, and much else. So all of those very famous and familiar phrases that you know from your King James Bible, they were first set into English by who? By William Tyndale in 1530, right? So his work has been enduring and influential upon even the King James Bible. Two generations later, in 1611, the scholars and divines who made the authorized version under King James were very happy to use what Tyndale had given them, though without acknowledgement. Very many great passages from the Pentateuch come to us from Tyndale. Like the blessing from number 6, quote, the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be merciful unto thee. The Lord lifted up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. So, again, another passage that you're familiar with that was first set into English by who? By Tyndale. Where are we at? Ringing phrases such as, for the Lord thy God is a consuming fire, or a mighty hand and a stretched out arm from Deuteronomy 4, or from Deuteronomy 6, For the Lord thy God is a jealous God, as well as thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. These and many, many more came to us from his Pentateuch. So all those statements are coming out of Tyndale's work from 1530. Alright? Yet that volume was less than half his Old Testament work. 2 years later, after his 2 years after his execution in 1535, and I think that should, that's a misprint actually in the book, I think it should be 1536, there appeared a thick folio Bible, also printed abroad, which announced itself as both set forth with the king's most gracious license, a point we will talk about next time, and truly and purely translated into English by Thomas Matthew. Matthew is a cover name. The volume was in fact assembled by Tyndale's close friend John Rogers, who later became the first Protestant martyr in England under the Catholic Queen Mary. In his Matthew's Bible, Rogers reprinted the Pentateuch and all of the New Testament directly from Tyndale. The section after the Pentateuch, from Joshua to 2 Chronicles, was also Tyndale's work. In this section there is, it has been said, no direct evidence. Yet, the strong likelihood, together with an overwhelming accumulation of internal effects, convinces both the general reader and the scholar that this is Tyndale, probably from his manuscripts entrusted to Rogers at his death. So, we're talking about this section right here. The Joshua to 2 Chronicles section. For a while, scholars had sort of debated whether or not this was really William Tyndale's work or not. And it's pretty much understood at this point that, yes, this was William Tyndale and that Rogers had access to Tyndale's manuscripts. And so we're going to look now at a case that Daniel makes here for why we should accept that view. Later in his introduction, Dr. Daniel presents his evidence for arguing that William Tyndale was the translator of the text of Joshua through 2 Chronicles found in the Matthew's Bible of 1537. For the sake of time and space, I have limited my citations of Daniel's work on this point to what I believe are his most important points. So again, I'm quoting from this 1992 publication here, the introduction. There's a lengthy introduction explaining all of this at the beginning of this book, Tyndale's Old Testament. So let's look at what he says. Matthew's Bible reprints Tyndale in the Pentateuch and the New Testament. From the end of 2 Chronicles to the end of the Old Testament, it reprints Coverdale, who is the translator of 2 Chronicles. So let's talk about that. So if you think about the Bible, you start off, what are the first five books of the Bible? Genesis through Deuteronomy, right? So, where did that come from? Where did that come from in the Matthew's Bible? I'm just going to put a T up here for Tyndale. That came from Tyndale, right? What about Joshua? What's next? We got Joshua through second what? You know what? I'm going to do it this other way or people won't be able to...
Anybody see the erasure? Here it is.
So this was Tyndale. I'm going to say Tyndale here. We'll talk about what that is. So what's after 2 Chronicles? Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, right? Then you have Job through Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. So that's the poetry section of the Old Testament, right? And then after Song of Solomon, you have what? Job, Psalms, Proverbs.
Okay, I gotta like say it. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Then you have
Isaiah, right? So then you have Isaiah through what? Malachi, right? And then you have your New Testament. I'm just going to say Matthew through Revelation. So, we know that the Pentateuch section was Tyndale. We know, and I shouldn't put that up here because this is what we're going to be talking about, but I'll go ahead and put it there. We know that that was Tyndale, and we know that the whole New Testament in the Matthew Bible was who? Was Tyndale. So anything in this section here, where did Matthew get his information from? He got it from whom? He got it from Coverdale.
Okay? So, is everybody following that? Okay?
So that's from actually Coverdale from the Latin ballgame.
So this section in here is not from a scholar translating from Hebrew. It's Coverdale translating from his, what he calls his five sundry interpreters, which included Latin, German, a couple different editions of Latin, a couple different editions of German. But he does not, Coverdale does not know Hebrew. I talked to you all about that in the lessons on Coverdale. Okay? So, these sections in here from Ezra to Malachi, basically the rest of the Old Testament, are coming from Coverdale. The section that we're discussing right now is whether or not that section there from Joshua to 2 Chronicles is in fact William Tyndale. Because until 1537, this section had never been printed before. Okay? Now Coverdale printed it, but he didn't print it. He printed his own translation of Latin. He didn't print a translation of what? Hebrew. But so Matthew, this is the portion of the manuscript that he rescues from obscurity by the Catholic authorities that is also believed to be the work of who?
Tyndale.
Is everybody following that? Not trying to be confusing there. So if I was, I'm sorry. I think it was clear, but...
How many languages did Coverdale know?
Coverdale did not know the original languages. He did not know Hebrew and Greek. He was not proficient in Hebrew and Greek enough to be able to make an entire translation. All right. Now, for political reasons, in Coverdale's New Testament and some of the sections where Tyndale was available, it's believed that he revised Tyndale himself in English. But sections like this, for which Tyndale had not done any work or it had not been printed yet, Coverdale is very reliant on Luther's German, the Latin Vulgate, and other sources other than Hebrew. Okay?
But Luther translated directly from the Hebrew.
Luther translates directly from Hebrew, yes. But Coverdale does not have a proficiency in that skill to be able to do it himself. Does that make sense? Which, again, speaks to Ernie, this purified seven times argument, right? That is very prevalent amongst King James advocates. I know you've heard people say, well, Psalm 12, 6, and 7, you know, silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times, thou shalt keep them, O Lord, thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever. And they then start counting the translations of the Textus Receptus, starting with Tyndale, and lo and behold, the King James is the seventh one, right? And so that, therefore, is somehow some uber spiritual point signifying the completeness. The problem with that is when you back up and you actually study it, Coverdale didn't translate from the preserved Hebrew and Greek. He's doing a translation of a translation. You follow that? So there's problems there. The other problems in my mind with the purified seven times argument is, well, which editions are we supposed to count? Do we count Tyndale's 1526? Do we count as 1534? Do we count as 1535? Do those all count as one? How do I know and what verse tells me how I'm supposed to count all this stuff? So that's just sort of going back to a point that we made earlier. So where are we at on this? I lost my spot. Oh. We're on the bottom of page 4. The case for this being Tyndale's work. So, referring to this section, Joshua 2 Chronicles. So this is what he's talking about now. The case for this being Tyndale's work rests on 5 points. The first three carry such weight as they make the ascription virtually certain. In other words, If you look at the first 3 points, it's pretty obvious that this was Tyndale's work, not somebody else's. Number one, Tyndale's way with Hebrew can be very much his own, as we have noted above. When he strikes out independently of any immediate influences, Luther, the Septuagint, the Vulgate, he leaves, as it were, his distinctive signature on his treatment of Hebrew words, the musical instrument that in Hebrew is considered translated, however you say that, a toph. It's in Hebrew, that's the Hebrew word toph, is consistently translated by Coverdale in the books from Ezra onwards as tabret. In the Pentateuch, Tyndale makes it timbrel, as this is the word in Judges 11, 1 Samuel 10, 1 Samuel 18, 2 Samuel 6, and 1 Chronicles 13. Examples of such continuity of idiosyncrasy, as we might put it, can be found many times and account to make a powerful case. So, what's he saying? He's saying in sections where we know for sure how Tyndale handled certain Hebrew words, we can go to this section here from Joshua to 2 Chronicles, and we can see that every time that Hebrew word appears in the text, it's rendered in this section using the renderings that Hoove used in the Pentateuch, Tyndale, which are different from the way Coverdale rendered those words. Therefore, speaking to the fact that whoever did this, Genesis through Deuteronomy, also did Joshua through what? 2 Chronicles. Okay? Number two, the translator of Joshua to 2 Chronicles shows exactly the same desire to make sense almost at all costs as Tyndale in the Pentateuch. It has been seen above that such nearly impenetrable Hebrew passages as the accounts of the furniture of the temple almost defeat him. The same can be said of the descriptions of the ritual vestments in Leviticus and Numbers. So in other words, the similarity between the way those things are rendered is so similar that it speaks to the same person did the what? Did the translation. Number four.
Verse 3.
I skipped 3 because it was long and it would take too long. If you want to read 3, I have it here if you want to check it out. And that's why I said on the previous page that for the sake of time and space, I limited it to just the things I thought were most pertinent. Okay, number four. There are some particular formulations in English phrasing in both men of activity, the literal, the fat of the land, observed dismal days, upon high mountains and on hills, and under every green tree, and very many more. And so in other words, those same noun of noun formulations that Tyndale is using in Genesis through Deuteronomy, he's using them also where? He's also using them in Joshua through 2 Chronicles. So this portion bears the hallmark marks of the same person who did what? Who did that portion? Number five. Finally, there is evidence of large ornamental initials in Matthew's. Those in the introductory matter, IR and HR, are taken to stand for John Rogers and Henchris Rex, before the prophets RG and EW are taken to be Richard Grafton and Edward Whitechurch, the London Whitchurch, the London printers who financed and distributed the volume, and WT at the end of the Old Testament before the Apocrypha. So let me find that. I have it marked. So you see these ornamental markings here? These are the initials WT. All right, so those are put there indicating that a ton of the Old Testament is coming from who? From Tyndale. Everybody saw that, right? Okay. Before the Apocrypha may be intended to suggest that the larger presence of William Tyndale in this volume. Edward Hall, in his Chronicle of 1548, adds the Old Testament historical books to a list of Tyndale's translations. Moreover, copies of Matthew's exist in which all the prologues and all the notes have been obliterated to escape the penalties that were threatened in 1543 when, as Bishop Westcott notes, Parliament postscribed all translations bearing the name of Tyndale and required that the notes and all other copies should be removed or obliterated. So, what does that mean? Okay? If you look at this Bible, we'll talk about this more later. Of course, I open to a page that doesn't have any. You'll see there are marginal notes. This Bible was printed in 1537. In 1543, the English Parliament was so ticked off still at Tyndale that they ordered that any Bible that was believed to have Tyndalean notes in it, that they be removed. And so there are actually surviving copies of the Matthew's Bible where somebody has gone through in accordance with that act of Parliament and scratched out the marginal notes and the initials that I just showed you. Okay? Now, why would they do that unless they believed that this Bible was largely the work of who?
Tyndale.
You following that? So, therefore, I think it is safe to conclude that Tyndale's translation accomplishments with respect to the Old Testament include the following before his martyrdom in 1536. So in 1530, he did the Pentateuch, which included a note to the reader, a prologue that included Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, as well as prologues to all those books. Then in 1537, so that'd be the Matthew's Bible here that we're talking about right now, it included Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and then it also included his rendering of Jonah. All told, Tyndale is responsible for penning the rough draft for 15 of the 39 books, or 38% of the Old Testament found in the King James Bible. In addition to producing full English renderings for the 15 books listed above, it is important to note that Tyndale's 1534 and 1535 New Testament revisions also included English translations for a select number of Old Testament passages not included in the preceding list. So I want to stop there. Is everybody tracking with this? So why is the Matthew's Bible so significant? The Matthew's Bible is so significant because it is the complete work of William Tyndale in print. Right? So I think we're on solid ground viewing Genesis through Deuteronomy as the work of Tyndale, Joshua through 2 Chronicles as the work of Tyndale, all of Ezra through Esther, the poetry books, and the prophets, save Jonah as Coverdale, and the whole New Testament as what? Tyndale in a Matthew's Bible. Everybody with that? So, the parts of Scripture found in the Matthew's Bible that had not been supplied by Tyndale were taken from Coverdale's Bible of 1535. Quote, for the parts of the Bible that Tyndale did not live to reach or just possibly finish, Rogers printed Coverdale. So, the high poetry from Job to Malachi, half the Old Testament, 22 books of poems and poetry, and 13 of the 14 books of the Apocrypha. So I'm not really caring about the Apocrypha here, but he does also take the Apocrypha from Coverdale. Rogers gives a version, albeit made by dedicated and learned men who could sometimes be splendid in his formulation, as we saw above, but who knew neither Hebrew nor Greek, Miles Coverdale. So he's referring to there this section that I have in a bracket here. So all this section here is coming from, including the Apocrypha, which I didn't include here on the board because I don't really give two hoots about the Apocrypha. All of that section there is coming from who?
Coverdale.
And again, Coverdale did not do his own work from Hebrew and Greek. He had to rely on other sources. So, recall from our previous studies that at this point, everything was political when it came to the English Bible. Neither the king, the head of the newly formed Anglican Church, nor his bishops would sanction or license a Bible believed to have come from the hand of Tyndale. Likewise, Coverdale missed out on crown sanction over the inclusion of King Henry VIII's estranged second wife in his dedication to the king. So you remember that? Where he includes the dedication to Queen Jane, but by the time the Bible had been printed, Queen Jane had fallen out of favor with Henry VIII, and he's about ready to chop her head off. So therefore, the king cannot really license Coverdale either because of this, you know, political issue related to Coverdale mentioning the king's wife, who he now no longer likes and needs to get rid of. You following that? Okay. So he's not going to sanction Coverdale, and he's for sure not going to sanction Tyndale, and he's also not going to sanction Coverdale. Likewise, Coverdale missed, I already got that. Therefore, Rogers, a known associate of Tyndale, published his Bible under the assumed name Thomas Matthew. So, I'm going to go back to this title page. Right here, in this box, right here, I'm going to read to you what it says in this box. It says, the Bible, which is all the holy scriptures in which are contained the Old and New Testament, truly and purely translated into English by Thomas Matthew. So Thomas Matthew is a pseudonym for who? John Rogers. And that's why this becomes known as the Matthew's Bible. So people get confused. Because you talk about the Matthew's Bible, but you're talking about John Rogers, and they're like, wait a minute, who are we talking about here? Matthew's or John Rogers? Well, they're one and the same person. All right? So, Tyndale's name was heretical. Rogers' volume could not be called Tyndale Bible, for no certain reason. The title page states, as I just read this to you, the Bible, which is all the holy scriptures, of which are contained the Old and New Testament, truly and purely translated into English by Thomas Matthew. The likelihood is that the name was chosen because it combines the names of two disciples. So the 12 apostles, one of them was named Thomas, another one was named who? Matthew, and it's believed that that's where the pseudonym came from, that he just took two names of the apostles and said, this is the work of Thomas Matthew. Okay? So we're almost done, top page 7. Fear of reprisals and persecution led some to take false names. Sometime while living in Antwerp, John Rogers took the name Thomas Matthew to conceal the fact that his translation work was closely associated with his friend, the hated William Tyndale. In the next lesson, we will look at the reception that the Matthew's Bible received in the English-speaking world, as well as discuss its contents and consider some of its readings. So I want to show you one thing here to just sort of notice. So this is the title page, right? Notice what it says down here at the bottom in red. I'll read it to you. It says, set forth with the king's most gracious license. Okay? In an ironic twist of fate, Henry VIII is going to license this Bible, which is two-thirds Tyndale, who he just executed. Okay, so we're going to talk about how that happened in the next lesson. All right? Does anybody have any questions or comments? So this is significant, and I'll talk more about this next time. So when the king licensed this, is he licensing a Bible that is two-thirds Tyndale? Yeah. So in 1539, when they're going to commit, when the king commissions the Great Bible, what the Great Bible is going to be is a revision of this. So how is the King James Bible 80% in the New Testament, William Tyndale? It's related to this, because this is Tyndale's New Testament, and the king just licensed it. Shock of all shocks, but that's what happens, right? So then in 1539, when Coverdale is going to edit the Great Bible, he's the base, what he's editing is this one. So then when the Bishop's Bible is done in 1568, that's a revision of the Great Bible. And the Great Bible was a revision of this Bible, which is two-thirds who? Tyndale. So when the King James Bible is translated, rule number one said that they should follow the bishops unless the truth of the original determined otherwise. So how is there this Tyndalean line going all the way through all these English Bibles? It's because of this one. This one is the pivotal one. And I didn't know that until I started studying this. So there's a lot to talk about there next week, but we do need to quit because of time. Does anybody have a last minute comment or question?
You think end of the eight never figured out what
I think the answer is yes, because of the Act of Parliament in 1543 ordering that any Bible that had Tyndalean notes in it, that the notes be what?
Removed. Okay.
So at some point, I think the answer to that is yes.
At what point then would it be the 1611 King James when they did not necessarily use part and partial the Coverdale portion of it?
Okay, so you're jumping way ahead of me.
I know, but I want to know the answer now.
Well, I'm not going to tell you the answer now for two reasons. Number one is I still stuff I have to check on before I give you an answer, because I don't want to give you the wrong answer. And the other thing is
your gut feeling good enough right now.
Well, my gut feeling then is that this section here is where the Geneva Bible is going to have particular impact, because the Geneva Bible is going to be translated by guys who knew Hebrew and Greek.
What year was that?
That was, the New Testament was 1557. The complete Bible was 1560. Okay. Anybody else have a question? I don't know. I tell you, like, you guys all know that I'm a nerd and I find all this stuff fascinating. But this Matthew Bible is absolutely essential for what ends up coming out three quarters of a century later from the King James translators.
So all these people during that time who covered the Bible, the Great Bible, the Matthew Bible, did they have the complete Word of God?
You just answered that.
That's a trick. So that's a trick question. I'm going to say, I have to say, yes, they had it in draft form, but in English, there were still some things that needed to be fixed. So they had it in the sense that they had everything that they would have needed to know the scriptures and to know God's word. But there were still some things, because of the English language and where the English language was in its development, that needed to be set up sort of permanently. And I think that's what the King James ultimately does.
So as the English language blossomed and bloomed, God gave us the...
The English, I'll say it this way. The English-speaking world was well aware of what was going on in their Bible, and English-speaking believers... I'm going to show you documentation in weeks ahead, I don't know when, of people in England calling for the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, to sanction a new translation of the Bible 20 or 30 years before King James even ascended the throne. So there was a chorus of voices in the English-speaking world before the coronation of King James to the English throne who were well aware that they needed yet another one because there were discrepancies between the bishops and the Geneva that needed to be worked out. Okay? And even King James himself, before he became King James I of England, he was the King James of Scotland, before he became the King of England, right? There's documentation that at a meeting of what's called the Scottish Kirk, which is the Scottish Church, that they discussed the need to have a new translation in English, and that King James, while he was still King of Scotland, before he also became King of England, sanctioned the Scottish Kirk to do such a thing. Nothing ever happened with it, with that project, but when the Hampton Court meeting is happening in 1604, and the Puritans say, oh, well, can you at least give us a new translation? The king says yes, because he's already been thinking about it for 5 years. And I'm going to show you all the documentation on that. That's just not the fairy stories of Brian Ross. There's actual evidence, concrete, hard evidence to suggest that everything I just told you is true.